everyone. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host. As usual, I'm here with Andy Steiger and Chris Battle.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, everyone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Who knows when you're listening to this, but
this
good morning.
True.
It's morning for us, so.
Yeah. Just before we started, we were talking about how we're just continually getting amazed at the kind of people that we run into all over the place that are actually listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
You were just at Breakforth this weekend.
Yeah, I was at Breakforth hanging out with Lee and
having Sean McDowell feed him steak.
I actually went out to dinner twice to Ruth Chris's steakhouse. Yeah, it was ridiculous. Hung out with Sean McDowell. Fantastic time with him. He's great. In fact, the waiter ripped into Sean something terrible. It was hilarious. Sean had taken a jab at the waiter, and then he found out Sean was from California and noticed that Sean had a faux hawk. He said, yeah, those were popular about 10 years ago.
I find this funny. At the same time, though, I'm a little bit perturbed because I noticed I've rocked the faux hawk recently, and so
you're bringing it back,
right?
Well, it's caused me to pause and reflect on my hairstyle a little bit.
But yeah, we were out there with Lee, Philip Yancey, Gary Chapman, a number of other people. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting was as we were at the conference, as I was just talking with people, speaking in different sessions, we met a number of people that listened to the podcast. Just want to give a shout out to you guys in Alberta and other parts of British Columbia. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, and I met some of you at Missions Fest this weekend, so hello.
Yeah, hello world.
Hello
world. This is really exciting for us to know that what we're doing is having such a wide impact. Our conference is coming up March 4th and 5th, Friday night and Saturday all day.
It's exciting.
Everything is looking great. People are signing up, and our numbers are looking good. We just wanted to highlight another speaker this week. I wanted to talk a little bit about Abdu Murray. And for those of you who are not very familiar with Abdu, he was a Muslim who became a Christ follower after a long journey. It's quite interesting. He's going to share a little bit about how he came to the Christian faith and the kind of process, the kind of process that it took to get there. He is also an attorney, from what I understand. So he has that background as well. And the dude is like 6 foot 10, I swear. He is.
No way.
Yeah.
Him and Nabil must be a pretty formidable duo, hey?
I guess so. I'm looking forward to meeting him. I've never met Abdu, actually. Yeah. I've met Nabil, but haven't met Abdu.
He's a very personable guy, and he knows his stuff. So I think you'll really appreciate him. And as is really kind of, I guess, typical of an RZIM speaker, he really knows how to engage both the head and the heart kind of a thing. He knows how to kind of put his finger on the sort of the emotional pulse, so to speak.
And he's also doing a breakout session as well, so you'll hear him twice on the main stage and breakout session.
Yeah, so on the
great
main
opportunity.
Stage, right, on the main stage, he'll share a little bit about his journey, and for the breakout session, he's going to talk about understanding the Muslim mindset. So Islam is coming to our doorsteps, and this might be a very good opportunity for you to acquaint yourself with Islam if you don't know it very well. And it's just going to be a great time altogether. So make sure you sign up. The discount code is still good.
Yeah, it's good till February 15th. It is Thinking16. So if you want to get your tickets, get them before Feb 15th and put in discount code Thinking16.
For 10% off.
Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. So let's move on then. Chris, you found yet again an interesting article on gene editing and how the UK government has approved it now.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The headline caught me, and it says the new technique offers hope for UK approves first studies of new gene editing technique, and it's CRISPR on human embryos. And this CRISPR, it stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, totally.
I've been doing
I
that
know
for
exactly
years.
What that means.
And I found that not helpful at all.
No, right? not even a little bit. All that I found helpful about it is it works apparently, and it's quite effective.
Exactly,
at gene editing.
The whole deal behind it, behind the science, essentially. There's actually a helpful little video that I found where the guy is in a minute and a half describes it, and he says,
"We'll post that up on our website."
And he essentially says, "Take if you're editing a book or any sort of document, and you come across the sentence, 'Twinkle, twinkle, big star.'" Mm-hmm. He said there's different ways you can go about editing it. You can either just take out big, so it's twinkle, twinkle, star, but that doesn't make sense. Or you can add in the word little, so it could be twinkle, twinkle, big, little star. And that doesn't make sense either. Or you could take out, splice out big and insert little. And essentially that's what this does, is it uses the clusters, the CRISPR, and it takes out, splices out, a piece of a gene in the DNA strand that they want to take out for whatever reason they deem necessary, and then replace it. They splice in a little template, and that actually grows. The cells grow into the proper thing that they want. And there you have a repaired strand of DNA. And they're able to do this. They're doing this on embryos.
Well, that's why this is significant, right? I mean,
exactly.
Right. In the past, there wasn't a way to effectively, you know, edit the genome and to do it with precision. But now this method allows you to be precise and to edit. But we've never edited a human, human DNA, and now they are. But like, so this is interesting because in the U.S. you can't do this.
No, U.S. it's still out of bounds.
Now in the UK they just passed it. Of course, in China you just do whatever you want.
It's game on. To the point where UK is quote unquote horrified with the implications of what the Chinese are doing with it. But they don't even go into details because I don't think they know.
You know it's bad because so the US is concerned about what the UK is doing, and the UK is concerned about what China's Chinese. Doing.
Yeah.
Now I think it's probably be helpful if we just define what an embryo is. An embryo is so that's, by the way, what the UK are working with. They're only working with an embryo, apparently. They're editing on embryos, letting them grow for a little bit, and then are
14 days. After 14 days, they just discard them, right? They let them die.
Okay. Yeah, because they're able to live outside of the womb. I'm a little bit sketchy on, but for 14 days, so they conceive them, do their gene splicing techniques, see what happens, and then allow them to die.
Yeah.
So a human embryo, you know, it's a fertilized egg that you have. It starts with a cell that begins to divide. And as that cell divides and divides, it begins to create, if you will, there's better words for this, a person.
Develop into a person.
Yeah, develop into a person. By dividing and whatnot, it's created into a person. Now that embryo is considered within the first between 1 to 8 weeks is an embryo. Once it gets past that, it becomes what is often referred to as a fetus. Now, of course, we would see human life as a Christian is at conception.
Right.
That is a human life, and we don't have time to get into that. What we wanted to get into was just letting people know what this is, why it's significant. And I think that there's a lot of ethical dilemmas that are going around this. I mean, besides the fact, we could talk just about the fact that this is a person that they are experimenting on. But I mean, just leaving that aside, I mean, what are some of the other ethical implications that the article brings up?
Well, it talks about changing essentially a person's inner workings. So if there's something that they talk about it in really vague language, but something that would an obstacle that would have them not developing quote unquote properly. So that would be things like if a baby has Down syndrome or anything, any other malady of that state. So they would say that that's not normal, quote unquote, and then they would want to fix that. So they could technically make perfect people.
Which oddly enough is a problem.
Yeah. How do we know what a perfect person looks like, or where are we finding that standard.
Well, that's the interesting part about the article, I thought, is that a lot of scientists are horrified at what's going on because we know that it's our imperfection at some level that actually is a – by that I just mean diversity.
Diversity.
That we require, we need diversity, and in fact that creates a healthy population. And once you start manipulating the human genome and you start to get rid of the diversity, that becomes problematic.
Yeah, because at this point, the researchers in the UK seem pretty adamant. They're like, we're not putting this back into a woman. They talk about the woman from the Francis Crick Center who's heading this project up, and they say she would never do that, or she's not going to do that because – and they don't
That's great for the UK, right? But what about these other countries like China and elsewhere? That they're like, well, like – you know, yeah, order a child, right? Like, what do you want? You want blue eyes, blonde hair?
Yeah.
You know, how tall?
And they can fix all that stuff. But, yeah, for some reason, people still think that there's, as you said, there's a gradient of ethics going on throughout the world. And one person...
There's a lot of gray area, too, right? There's a lot of unknowns. Like, what happens once you start editing the genome?
Yeah.
What happens... Like, will we become more susceptible to disease, for example?
Yeah.
And a whole number of other challenges.
I mean, there are obviously there are certain things that are obviously good, right? I'd be happy to see somebody not have to suffer through what I'm suffering through, for example, like some mild case of asthma and eczema, that sort of a thing, right? I'd be happy to be gone. But yeah, what happens if we start changing what seems to us to be like sort of some essential feature of a human being, right? Where is that line? There isn't a clear line. The more you, it's like pushing boundaries and you're really flirting with, you know, playing God.
Yeah. Cause right now their goal, they say, is just to better understand how the biological process of embryonic development and gene development and things like that work and how they react to being manipulated. And that's it. That's to them the goal of this scientific project. But what happens when that's no longer good enough?
Well, right. That's always the problem.
When the next question raises, well, what happens if we put this in a person? Can one of these embryos go? So we'll just let it develop, see how well it develops, and then we'll just abort it.
Right.
That's
a slippery slope problem. Yeah. It's this double-edged sword, right? Because they've learned a lot, for example, about mice. And through doing this. So they've been doing this for a while on mice and they've learned different things and they're able to help in different illnesses. But there's always this drop, there's this balancing act that happens, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever, you know, scientific discoveries we have, you have to ask yourself, well, what's the cost to for those discoveries, right? Added to the fact that what are the potential problems in the future if we continue down this path?
Yeah, well, what I'm concerned about here is, you know, since we're talking a lot about dehumanization lately, that's what I'm worried about, right? Basically commodifying a human person and saying, okay, well, blonde hair, blue eyes, is that what you want? Like, we can create one for you, kind of a thing, you know? Or we can edit one to suit your personal preferences. So you're basically turning a human person into a product at that point.
Yeah.
And when you start treating a person like a product, you can bet there's going to be all kinds of things following after.
Oh, I was actually thinking about that because I thought, well, what if we start, you know, editing for servants? You know, maybe we could start editing for certain servant traits. I mean, maybe we could try to even edit out consciousness, you know? Like, I mean, where does that stop, right?
Yeah.
Where we really do just have, you know, a whole new breed of people. They're just these zombie people, right? They're the servants or what? Or maybe we need some more pilots, maybe. And so we start editing for pilots. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is just – now all of a sudden, here's the problem that I see. And that is we have a culture right now that's primed for this kind of stuff. Like in academia right now, there's a number of people that, for example, a number of profs that would teach that we don't actually have free will, right? I mean, we're just stardust, as Carl Sagan said, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't have free will, well, then what's the problem with manipulating a person? Mm-hmm. You're not doing anything to them. You're not taking away their free will. They didn't have any free will to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, even in that line, what's a person in the first place? Yeah. Right. If we're not really people anyway, if that's sort of just something we're deluding ourselves with, then this is fair game.
So there's no essential difference between you know, Michelangelo sculpting David and us gene editing, right?
There's we're just no, the same stuff. It's just reordering problem. Matter.
Not on on the current worldview that dominates secular culture, there is no difference.
No difference, no.
Exactly.
Maybe this is a good segue into the topic that we want to get into, and that is that everything changes if you have a creator. If you if God exists and God created us, it means that life has purpose. It means that that you do have a free will, or at least could have a free will. It starts to change the worldview. And so we wanted to get into a new topic on God's existence.
Yeah, we're starting a series on worst apologetics arguments
ever. So,
I've been so looking forward to this.
Yeah. See, Andy and I have been, you know, teaching the thinking series and things like that, and we've been marking papers, and every now and then we see an argument that just causes us to, you know, facepalm, that sort of
thing. Oh, my goodness. We pick up a chair and we throw it through a window, and then we got to pay somebody to come, you know, fix the window. It's just ridiculous. You have no idea. Yeah. I've seen Steve throw his laptop across the room.
Yeah. I just
Why?
I lose hope in humanity for a split second.
That's not valid. So there's a bunch of atheists out there right now that are amening us. Listen, what we want to do in this series is we just want to talk about the worst arguments for God's existence that we've ever heard.
And hopefully encourage us to stop using them.
Yes.
If it's in the arsenal. If it is, we love you.
You may need to unholster this argument.
Yeah. It's the one in question today we're talking about is the
And it's my favorite. Sorry. This is my favorite.
Andy loves this argument. We've had numerous guffaws over it, but it's known as the banana argument.
That alone, right? It's the banana argument. That should say something right there.
Yeah. It sounds like a joke just talking about
it. Okay. So I got to tell you the first time I heard it. Now, we haven't been able to find the clip, or else we'd love to show it for you, but I'll never forget it. I was watching Kirk Cameron being interviewed, and somebody said to him, okay, listen, you got 30 seconds to prove God exists. Go. And he grabs a banana, holds it in his hand, lifts it up to the camera, and says, see, God exists. And he begins to peel the banana, and then he takes a bite. And it was one of those face palms. I threw my computer across the room, right, or TV through the window, like, yeah, I was just like, you've got to be kidding me.
So what exactly was he trying to prove there by holding up the banana and peeling it and eating it?
Well, at first I thought that the banana is quite tasty. But then I realized, no, there's more to this.
Yeah. With the,
he gets it from somebody, we realize later.
Yeah. He's a disciple of Ray Comfort, and we appreciate their attempts at trying to – they love the Lord. We'll say that.
Yeah, we're not trying to diss them. Dissing the argument.
Just dissing the argument. It's not the person. We love the person. Yeah, love the person, hate the argument. It's so essentially the way it works is the banana appears to have design, and the way they say it is that there's a certain amount of grooves on one side, and when you make a hand holding like a gripping motion, there's a certain amount of grooves that are created by our fingers. And then on the other side of the banana, there's two grooves. And on the lower by the thumb, there's two grooves. So it fits into the hand perfectly. It's got the peel of the banana is a non-slip grip. It peels in perfect ways. It folds sort of neatly around the hand. It's user-friendly. And it bends towards the mouth, so it's easy to go in the mouth. And that the peel itself on the outside, when you're just looking at a banana, green is go, yellow is just, or green is too soon, yellow is just right, black is bad. So it's got an external meter that can tell us its state. So all of these imply that God created us and the banana to work together.
Plus, the banana's delicious.
It is delicious. But this funny thing is I like my bananas more green. So that kind of, I don't know how that works in the, maybe I'm broken, but.
I've been saying that for years. I like my bananas.
Nothing new here.
I like my bananas a little on the black side. But let's talk about this. What's the problem with this argument? I'm going to tell you right now, there's a number of problems with this argument.
Yeah. Where do we start?
But where do we begin? First of all, let's start with this one. What's the logical fallacy? I've been thinking about this. What's the logical fallacy?
It sounds to me like circular reasoning.
I think. I think it begs the question.
Yeah.
I think circular reasoning would definitely apply. The one that I thought of was confirmation bias.
Oh, confirmation bias, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like cherry picking things about it that fits your
right. It's you are looking at the banana and you are cherry picking for those traits that fit
right.
what you want. Now,
in my blog, I described it as shooting an arrow into a wall
yeah.
and then painting a bullseye around it.
Which is a great example. And this mm-hmm. is the problem. That's why when people – so by the way, what's the argument then that they're trying to make? I think they're making a teleological argument.
Yeah, they're trying to make a design argument.
They're trying to make a design argument, which falls into this idea of – what many would talk about with regards to like specified complexity,
mm-hmm.
right? So you need the bullseye drawn before you shoot the arrow. See, because mm-hmm. the problem is with a confirmation bias is I can think of a number of different fruits that don't fit,
mm-hmm.
you know, this design argument. So now what do you do with those? Well, you've cherry picked the fruit you want that's mm-hmm. going to fit your bias.
A friend of mine actually replied underneath my blog on this topic that came out on Tuesday. And he pointed out that same thing. He's like, the variety of fruit mm-hmm. we have, it just stands to reason that eventually one of them would mm-hmm. kind of fit into this.
Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. That's the problem with complexity. When you're making a design argument, you need a couple things. Now, you could talk about like irreducible complexity.
See Michael Behe.
Yes, exactly. And he does good work on that. So we won't talk on that. But that one just being that you need the whole. You can't arrive at it from the individual parts. They need to come together at once. But then there's two others that are necessary if you're going to make a design argument. You need improbable complexity, which, by the way, isn't rare. There's lots of improbable complexity all around us. I mean, our world's full of complexity. Like, imagine you had a handful of marbles. You threw them on the ground. I mean, that's an improbable complexity of arrangements with where they landed,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that's a complex pattern. But we wouldn't really think of it too much because you didn't specify. That's why you need the next one, specified complexity, because you didn't specify beforehand what was required, right? So that's the whole drawing the bullseye around the arrow argument. You need the bullseye. And then you shoot the arrow. So we're looking at that point then for design specified complexity.
So mm-hmm. for example, you go to Mount Rushmore and you see the faces of the past U.S. presidents.
By the way, as you can tell, Steve's still trying to get over his cold. Yeah. He's not quite there.
Not quite there.
It's a valiant effort though. He is fighting it.
Yeah, one of these days. I need some gene editing. So you see the independent patterns of the faces of the United States presidents, certain ones from the past, and you see it on the mountainside. Now mm-hmm. you see that, and you don't go, wind and erosion did that.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, you can't, because what you've got is you've got specified complexity. Mm-hmm. We know what their faces look like. And it's matching.
There's the bullseye already.
Yeah, there's the bullseye, and then it's matching. So that would be incredibly improbable complexity for that to have come about. So now when you're looking at a banana, I mean, you know, how could we make this argument, I think, that they're trying to make?
With a banana specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make it even with a banana specifically. The way I would do it personally mm-hmm. is I would drop all the way down to the molecular. I would be looking at the design of the banana itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Like, and that's the origins of life argument, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, and this is something that Dawkins and others, they fully appreciate. They understand it. It's why they'll appeal to a multiverse, or they'll appeal to alien seeding life and different mm-hmm. things like that. Because what we seem to have is specified complexity.
So you'd back it up the steps until it demanded an explanation that didn't involve chance or...
See, that's the problem. When you're mm-hmm. looking at, say, a banana or anything that's living, and you see what it's made of, right? It's, you,
right.
you drop it all the way down, it's you know, the simplest life that they're made of is cells, but right. cells are made up of proteins, and proteins are made up of amino acids. Well, now you have to ask yourself, well, amino acids and proteins aren't living things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can't evoke like a Darwinian explanation on these. You, right. you need some other way of explaining how this vast amount of information, you know, we were talking earlier about the human genome. I mean, mm-hmm. that's 3 billion letters long, the human genome. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's information rich. The simplest protein is made up of 250 correctly sequenced amino acids, mm-hmm. of which you have around 20, a little over 20, to choose from. I mean, those odds are astronomical. And in fact, I think William Dembski did some great work on this as he talks mm-hmm. about the probabilistic resources of the universe. I mean, is there even enough time and opportunity in the universe to get to sequence one functional protein? Mm-hmm. You know, let alone the simplest cell, which is made up of around 250 yeah. Functional proteins. And by the way, those proteins range in complexity. Mm-hmm. So we know of nothing other than just blind chance that can do that, except DNA. God.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. DNA. Okay. And, yeah, which you have to ask yourself, who created DNA, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because you got specified complexity there.
Yeah. Well, chance won't do it because it's just way too improbable.
Yeah.
So rationally, you want to appeal to something else, something, some intentionality, I guess, something that kind of put this together.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the alien hypothesis is attractive for them, because it mm-hmm. still posits a mind, but all that does is push it back.
Yeah. So
one step further.
Who created the alien?
Yeah, exactly.
He was talking about probabilistic resources, right? Mm-hmm. So that makes things even more difficult then, because now you have another intelligent species to account for within this
a smaller
limited
amount of time. And that's something resource. That a lot of people yeah. don't realize too, that when a guy like Dembski gives the probabilistic resources of the universe, he's being overly generous. Mm-hmm. You know, he's talking about how long has the universe been around, how large is it, how many opportunities for these kind of things to take place if you were to fill the universe mm-hmm. with sequencing amino acids.
Right.
Right? I mean, what are your potential? And the problem is, you know, just take our galaxy, our solar system. It has not always been life viable. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, in the history of the universe, particularly in our galaxy, we've only had a very small window in which it could even sustain life.
Right.
So when you start looking at, you know, where are there in the universe of life-sustaining opportunities, mm-hmm. let alone just the opportunity throughout the universe, you start to realize that the available time mm-hmm. is way less than would be required. I mean, way, way less than
and this
would be
is,
required.
So then this leads people sometimes to posit eternal universe. But I mean, I don't know of anybody now right. that
or the,
anybody
or
respected.
The multiverse.
Yeah,
so
or the multiverse.
Where this just opens up the Pandora's box, where mm-hmm. literally then, okay, if we're going to say there's just, you know, an infinite amount of universes that we just happen to be a part of, like yeah. literally now everything becomes possible.
Yeah.
Right.
So there is a universe in which I'm actually sitting in Andy's spot talking yeah. about this, and Andy's mm-hmm. sitting in your spot, Chris, and Chris, you're sitting in my spot. That's
yeah.
yeah, because now everything can become possible. So the one, though, that I hear that, you know, a lot of people will try to find, they haven't found it, is there in chemistry, is there in nature an organizing principle that, mm-hmm. that you know, information will just naturally arise, that will just naturally organize or sequence amino acids into functional proteins. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, nothing like that has been found, but it doesn't stop people from looking, particularly when you have a worldview that's a purely physical worldview in which God does not exist or can't exist. Mm-hmm. Well, then you'll look for any option, because any option is preferable, because you hold to a worldview that just doesn't even allow mm-hmm. for God's existence. And this is where the design argument, quite honestly, becomes problematic in secular culture today. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how much design you show. Mm-hmm. God's just not even a potential option within their worldview. So right. anything is more probable or possible to them than God, even if it's the yeah. multiverse.
Yeah, I remember listening
to... Or aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember listening to Sean McDowell once, and he was he went to an atheist meeting, and he was there as a Christian, kind of fielding questions and that sort of a thing.
Hmm.
And he got to the point where at some point he was taking questions about the Kalam cosmological argument. And these two atheists were dead set. Like Sean actually asked them, so you're telling me that it is more probable that the universe has kind of popped into existence out of nothing at all than the hypothesis that a creator, some transcendent personal creator, created the universe? And they were both like, yeah, of course, right? Because their worldview already ruled out a transcendent creator. It was more probable for them that the universe literally came into existence out of nothing at all.
Yeah, from nothing by nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a matter of their presuppositions, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how much design you throw at them. They'll be like, there's got to be something else. They'll Richard Dawkins will even punt to alien species.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking sci-fi here?
But just to end on, I think that's why a lot of people need to understand when they do talk about design, this is one of the reasons why you can so easily just talk right past your friend. Because just the design argument just isn't valid for them, because it doesn't matter how good it is. It's just not an option.
Yeah. So, but yeah, the moral of the story, banana argument, false.
Yeah.
It fails. It tries to be design argument, but it doesn't. It doesn't cut.
Yeah, it's got a confirmation bias.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's leave it there. Well, thank you for joining us. We'll come back next week with another worst apologetic argument ever, and we'll continue in that.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. In the meantime, try not to slip on a banana peel. And speaking about confirmation bias. Anywho, thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week.